Welcome to the Outsource Accelerator podcast. This is a short format podcast where we explore business and outsourcing mastery. My name is Derek Gallimore, and I am really excited to bring you the leading podcast in outsourcing. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Welcome back. This is episode number 254. Today, I am being interviewed by Ben Gothard of the Project Egg podcast. I had a really good conversation with Ben. We spoke about everything, of course. We spoke a lot about outsourcing, but also the earlier stages of my business journey, and we also get a little bit philosophical with things. So I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope that you get something out of it as well. As always, if you want to go to the show notes, then you can find those at outsourceaccelerator.com/254. Enjoy.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another exciting episode of the Project Egg Show. Today, we're still in Austin, but we have now moved into my sister's office. So shout out to you, Amy. You rock. Thank you for lending your space to the Project Egg Show. Today, we have the honor of speaking with Derek Gallimore, a serial entrepreneur. Welcome, Derek. How are you doing, man?
Hi, Ben. Yeah, thanks so much. I'm super excited to be here. And I'm loving your...
Oh, I think we've had a little bit of a internet thing. Derek, you kind of cut out on us a little bit. I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you had to say.
Yeah, no, it seems all right now, but great. I'm super happy to be here and on this live chat.
Awesome. So let's jump right in it. Let's get right to the core of it. What is your story?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. I've got a few stories, but look, my main drive and purpose at the moment is to help other business people, entrepreneurs, startups with outsourcing. So I'm based here in Manila in the Philippines. I'm an absolute entrepreneur at heart, serial entrepreneur for better or worse. It's an incurable disease, I think. But yeah, I discovered outsourcing in about 2011 and really believe that it is the most powerful, most transformative business tool available today. And I'm trying to spread that word.
All right, well, let's start from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I hear other people who are serial entrepreneurs, I get like insanely curious. How'd you get into that? Like, what's your story? Where did you get the whole entrepreneurial spirit from?
Yeah, I don't know where it particularly came from. My parents weren't entrepreneurial. They were very sort of steady middle class and were always encouraging me to be stable and safe and, you know, head down the middle of the path. But right from a very young age, I got a lot of inspiration from movies, and I really kind of aspired to what I think then was the kind of whole Wall Street vibe. But then I believe culturally it kind of evolved into the whole Silicon Valley vibe and startup and entrepreneurial vibe. But yeah, you know, I suppose notably started a personal training business when I was about 16. And I, you know, looking back, there was just a lot of kind of activities that really set me down this pathway to self-employment and entrepreneurship, really.
So you're talking about some of those movies. What movies really inspired you?
Yeah, well, you know, to be honest, I'm not the best at movie recall and quotes from movies, but you know, the whole Wall Street thing, called Wall Street, and just the kind of, not so much obviously that is a 9-to-5 job, but the kind of the deal making, the power broking, the fancy suits, the you know, the kind of, as they were referred to then, like the masters of the universe. Those kind of aspects were super, super exciting to me. You know, I was never a kid that was necessarily into sports, watching sports or music, or, you know, it was really the kind of business scene that really got me super excited.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think one of the modern day, or a little bit more modern day examples of that is like The Wolf of Wall Street.
Mm.
Or The Big Short, or, you know, movies like that, where, I mean, it's intoxicating, that yeah. sort of lifestyle and how it's portrayed. And I feel like it's so easy to get wrapped up into that game of like, wow, this is like everything that I've ever wanted. So it's interesting that, you know, it definitely translated into something very, very positive for you. But I feel like that does have negative effects on people who, you know, they see, like, they think businesses, oh, I'm just going to get fucked up all the time, and then just have this one sick idea and just be super corrupt and break the law, and everything's going to turn out fine. I'm going to be, you know, a billionaire. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, it's probably not the best way to go about it, but, you know, it's each their own. So,
yeah. It's that blend, isn't it, of, you know, sort of the ends justifies the means versus being a good person throughout. And there's a lot of kind of mixed cultures and messaging in there, you know. Yeah, obviously the Wolf of Wall Street, he's a pretty bad guy and selling penny stocks and boiler rooms and all that sort of stuff. But he's obviously glorified. And I'm sure a lot of people that read that book or watch that movie, a lot of kids are kind of pretty inspired by that, and they're probably trying to figure out how to do that themselves. But, you know, I think Silicon Valley, I think somehow they're kind of a cleaner version of Wall Street, and they're, at least they have this narrative of they're becoming billionaires by trying to save the planet and make everywhere a better place. I'm not too sure how genuine that is necessarily, but yeah, it's an interesting evolution.
So you were 16. You started your first business, personal trainer.
Mm, yeah.
And that's an early age to start your first business. How did you know what to do? Like, where did that idea come from, and why personal training?
Yeah, I mean, it was an easy step into business, because I was at that stage then super into the gym and exercising and weights and hanging around the gym a lot. And you get this a lot with like gym bunnies that then progress into being a personal trainer. So for me, it was an easy step into this entrepreneurship. But, you know, it introduced me to the fact that to be a personal trainer then in this gym, you had to pay like an overhead fee to basically buy that access license. So it introduced me into sort of fixed overheads, and then all the concepts of small business. You know, how do you promote yourself? How do you outshine compared to all the other personal trainers in the gym? How do you build relationships? But also, you know, how do you differentiate your service then? Because what I've found with personal training is, you know, you can't really offer that much different to your competitor. Also, you could offer the best product or service, but a lot of the decisions with personal training was made on the basis of your relationship with the person. Like if you got on great, you could still be training them really bad, but if you got on great with them, then the relationship would last. So yeah, I really learned interesting things. And one of the significant things I learned with that as well is that you are just, it's not very scalable because you're only trading an hour of your time for a relatively high fee, but it is an hour of your time. And I observed that personal training businesses or franchises were very difficult to then build, to build a hierarchy or scale it, because you know, it was based on this relationship kind of environment, and you can't necessarily photocopy your relationship or your personal style. So it's, yeah, it was on many levels a really good lesson about the early stages of business and how to kind of scale things.
That is a tremendously powerful lesson that I feel like most people don't ever get. But like the fact that you were exposed to that lesson, or I say exposed, I'm not trying to diminish the fact that that took a ton of work and effort on your part. But like, you know, you exposed yourself to that lesson at such a young age. That's incredible. That's incredible. And I feel like that really is a critical mindset shift, that it's hard to see it when you're in it and you've just been doing it that way for so long. And it's like, well, I have to go to work and put in my certain amount of time. I own my own business, but like I'm self-employed. So I have to go in and do that in order to get paid. Well, you don't actually have to. And you could structure your business in a way that you don't have to put in the time to trade it for money. But I think that that is a profound lesson to learn at that young age. So once you learn that lesson and lessons, and you saw like, okay, this is going to be much harder to scale, did you continue with that business or did you do something else? What happened at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I was always sort of, you know, going down the safe route, and I was getting a degree at that time. Obviously, I was young at that time. I left school a year earlier than most. I went to university a year earlier. So I was sort of progressing relatively quick. I got a degree by the time I was 18 or 19 now. So I came out the other end pretty quick. But then, you know, I went and got a normal job because, you know, of the stability. And also I was kind of 19. I moved country at that time. So I moved from New Zealand to Australia. So there was still a bit of activity and you still learn within that environment. But, you know, I was always frustrated with the 9-to-5. I was immensely sort of, I remember any routine that you had to do, whether it was, I don't know, turn up the same day at 9 o'clock, or every day at 9 o'clock, was immensely frustrating to me. And I think that's a bit of a sort of, I don't know, ADD child mindset, you know. I've settled down a lot now, but really it's just the routine of things. And I was always looking for my own little projects, my own little venture. The ways of...
Hey, we had a little bit of a connection issue. The last thing we heard was you always had your own little side projects.
Yeah, so I always had my own little side projects, and you know, it wasn't popularized the way that it was now in terms of startups and incubators and accelerators and pitch contests. So it was more of a lonely journey where you just had to carve out your own path. But I was always kind of exploring those things. Yeah.
Wow. So you went into college really, really early, and you got out really, really early. That's fascinating. How do you think that, well, first of all, how did you do it? And second of all, how do you feel like that impacted you, being so much younger than everybody else you were surrounded by?
Yeah, I mean, I was only really, I suppose, 1 year younger. I skipped 1 year, but then I was also a young child in my class. So it was just the combination of those, which probably made me 18 months younger than the average kind of thing. But I was always one that felt frustrated with school, that I didn't really fit in, that, you know, a lot of the education, a lot of the lessons we were doing were pointless, which again is sort of an ADD child kind of issue. I don't necessarily think that's all accurate, but yeah, you know, I was super excited to get out of school and be an adult right from probably as early as I could remember. You know, when I was like 12 years old, I just wanted to be an adult, wanted to be doing adult things in adult business. And certainly for my first kind of, you know, up until about 30, I always felt that I was adulting kind of thing, like trying to do more adult things ahead of my time. But now I think it's kind of caught up with me a little bit.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I'm curious, what was the decision of what you wanted to study in school? Because it seems like you weren't really the biggest fan of it. And so, but you had probably had to pick something. Like, so what was that whole decision-making process?
Yeah, it was really just going along for the ride, you know. And I think as you're a child or growing up, you have less control, less insight, and, you know, into all these factors. And, you know, there are the sort of common courses you take. And I just took one of the common courses, SAFE courses, which kind of gives you a bit of foundational knowledge, but I didn't really study that much and didn't really absorb that much. So it was just really, I just saw it as almost a rite of passage and things that you have to do. It was just that. And, you know, I kind of bid that goodbye as soon as I could and kind of moved on. But I did, you know, I weirdly eventually went back and did a master's when I was in London, because I felt that I just had to sort of hedge my bets with things. But, you know, generally I'm a sort of, I don't want to encourage others to be, but generally I'm sort of relatively anti-institutional education kind of thing. I think that there's a lot better education you can do on the street or in apprenticeships or kind of as you're going through life, really.
So let's say you're back at the end of high school, or whenever you're making these decisions. So you have to plan a little bit and get it all. But let's just say, for the sake of the discussion, the end of high school, you can now decide, okay, I'm going to go do whatever I want. What's your next step? How do you educate yourself at that point?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's very different now because there's this massive ecosystem about startups and entrepreneurship and huge support systems, which is fantastic. And now people go to university to be an entrepreneur. Whereas when I think I was in education, an entrepreneur, and I think the true entrepreneurship is really going down the path least trodden and going against the grain. I think fundamentally, you know, you look at Alexander Graham Bell that invented the telephone and the guy that invented the electric light bulb, and, you know, all these people, they're doing it by themselves against fundamentally society saying it can't be done. And I think now the system is changing so that it's becoming so easy to become an entrepreneur that it's actually really just like a standard job. You know, you sort of follow these processes, follow these steps, and then you're an entrepreneur, and then you get funded, and then you have a startup, and then it probably fails, and then you do another one. And now it's just too mapped out. Whereas back when I was a kid, I think it's a little bit like being in the closet. You got to figure it out yourself. And there wasn't so much guidance along the way. What would I do now? You know, I would definitely embrace entrepreneurship a lot more. It would obviously be a lot more clearly defined. If I had 2020 vision, I probably would have created like a Google search engine and then a Facebook, kind of social platform or something. But yeah, you know, I think just embracing that a little bit more.
So that is very fascinating about the difference between entrepreneurship, you know, what is this, maybe 15, 20 years ago at most, and today, right? Which one do you think is better? Which one do you think is, and I know better is a totally subjective term, but which one do you think is better?
Look, I struggle when things get a little bit too institutionalized. And I think fundamentally entrepreneurship is a bit anti-establishment and contrarian. I think the fundamental definition of entrepreneurship is finding solutions to problems that haven't been solved yet. And I think when the institution gets behind it, and then there's this hard cut out path, then actually it's no longer entrepreneurship. And you will get, you know, a lot of people working on problems. You'll get a lot of graduates going into these paths, but I don't think that it's necessarily the best form of self-selection. But yeah, absolutely, definitely. I think it's good to have these support networks. All of this pitch competitions and accelerators and incubators and, you know, Y Combinators, they're all incredible things. But I do sometimes worry that people now go down this path because that's what everyone else is doing, and it's not really the right path for them, and they're probably not that efficient in that scene. You know, when I was a kid, like 15, 20 years ago, the top, they were all going to university, doing finance, doing sort of maybe a finance kind of to get into the investment banks. And again, that was maybe my Wall Street kind of culture. But now everyone wants to start in a $2 startup, you know, and that's fine. But the startups are very high risk. And if 99 or 95% fail, then the averages are that if you start in startups when you're 20, you go through three startups, then the average is that you'll be in three failures by the time you're 30, and then you're picking up the crumbs of a career. Whereas, you know, if you went into an investment bank, you would learn from the best bankers. You would be, it's a bit like going into the army. You would be put into this tough discipline, this environment, and you would come out with a skill set. So I'm sort of worried about, you know, maybe 10 to 20 years from now, where everyone realizes this startup thing, you know, is a little bit patchy in terms of building good foundational skills, skill sets, discipline, and things like that.
And that is a really interesting perspective. I've never thought about it that way. Because
it's interesting. I mean, you know, and I have this thing because I'm in startups. I mean, my thing is a startup effectively, but I've built businesses before and I'm generally pro bootstrapping. But I just, when there's all this VC money, encouraging people to build and fail fast, then people don't have as much skin in the game. They come up with an idea. They're like, you know, I want to raise $1 million. 3 months later, they get tired. They hit a bump in the road, and then they want to start something new. And I think that when there's a lot of money around, it's great. But it's sort of building a foundation of people just kind of throwing away ideas, money, opportunities, and things like that.
Yeah, and that seems like a few layers of problems there, because one, it seems like it's so fascinating that you said the people who that may not even be the best space for them, they get sucked up into that culture and into that way of thinking. They're like, yeah, I'm going to go get started. I totally would be an entrepreneur. But that might not be what they're best at. And I think everybody can be an entrepreneur, but I feel like you have to really want it. You have to really, really want it, because it is hard. I mean, it is really, really hard. Maybe I'm doing it wrong, but it is hard. And like, I think to have people going into the wrong thing for them, like the wrong space, that's not a good thing. So you have people in the wrong position for them, right? That creates problems of its own, because then the problems aren't going to get solved, because money will be allocated to the people who ask for it. And if a lot of those people are not the right people, then that, like you said, that money's going to be wasted. So the problems aren't going to be solved. The innovation is not going to happen as quickly as it could if the money went to the right people. Mm-hmm. But then you also have this whole like generation of people who probably don't have the skills, or maybe they do, but like you said, they haven't really been building anything sustainable that is going to continue to produce income for them. And so either they have to keep starting up, but then the money may dry up. So that's a whole nother, there are a lot of problems there.
Yeah. Because, you know, not everyone is, look, and it depends what you want out of life. Like, you know, not everyone is going to be a high performer, commits everything. And, you know, people shouldn't necessarily do that. People deserve just to have a good 9-to-5 job where they go in, they do their work, and they come home and enjoy their life outside of the office. But, you know, a place like an investment bank can carry people, and they can still get a good career, and they can still do well, and they can still develop skills and still go on. Whereas a startup, it's all or nothing. And if you look at it from a VC point of view, they know they're betting on horses, and they know that 95% will fail, but their numbers work out because 5% succeed, and then they make money, so their mission is complete. Whereas the 95% that fail, that is obviously the vast majority of people that dedicate their lives and careers to this. And it's just, it is by definition a failure. And this is part of the normal system. So it's a little bit of a worry if, you know, you spend the first 10 years of your career in failures. And these failures, it's not just like, you know, it's really hard work, and a failure is depressing, and it's stressful, and you often don't have the resources you need for personal development and things like that. So, it is going to be an interesting situation, I think, in 20 years when there's been this whole sort of slew of kind of startup environments. Be interesting to see.
Do you think there's a panacea? Is there anything we can do to prevent that, or at least prepare for when that happens?
No, I mean, you know, I don't want to sort of pretend that I'm any kind of commentator sort of thing, but I think it's a trend. I think people will, like anything, you know, Wall Street was a trend, and now no one wants to be on Wall Street because it's kind of, who wants to do a boring office job? I think it will just cycle around again, you know, something else will become popular, you know, and a few people say, like, now people even don't want to do startups or be an entrepreneur because that is hard work. People just want to be an influencer, you know, and the kids these days just want to be on Instagram or, to sort of create a following like that. So I think things do evolve, it's ultimately good for society to have this freedom and flexibility. Like, you know, a lot of economists said historically that by this time we shouldn't need to work. And maybe this is an embodiment of that. You know, we start to chase more loftier projects instead of, you know, 50 years ago, you would do an apprenticeship and go into a factory and that was your life. And then you retire 40 years later. So maybe this is the sort of embodiment of more economic self-actualization or something. Who knows?
Well, hopefully, yeah. Because if people are self-actualized, then that would hopefully mean that they're in the right place. Because before you get there, you have to get the respect. And if you're not good at what you do, you ain't going to get no respect. Yeah. So I'm really hoping that that's the case. That would be the best case scenario. Because, like, if everybody's doing what they're the best at and they're feeling just rock solid, on fire, totally crushing it, then we're going to have a very, very productive workforce. And that's really good news. And, like, we can all make the world a better place together. Yeah, I really hope that's the case. I really, really do. I want to weave your story back into the narrative here, because I feel like we went on a tangent, an epic tangent. But I want to get back to your story. So you came out of university. You then enter the workforce. What position? Where were you in the workforce? And then take us through the chronology until your next business.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lost couple of years. Really, I was just sort of bumping around fairly standard jobs. This is when I moved to Sydney, Australia, from. Where was it? From New Zealand, where I sort of grew up and trained. And then it was a couple of years, which then to me, to a sort of 20-year-old or whatever, seemed like a lifetime. But it was really just doing, you know, the standard office jobs, the standard sort of 9-to-5, the standard sort of things, which was informative. And during that time, I was also then also trying to explore and launch new ideas, just very sort of gently as a part-time thing. And then by about 21, I think I went to South America for a year. So I traveled around South America. I did the whole backpacking thing, and just basically
kind of rocked around South America, kind of partying and enjoying myself. That was a good year.
That's awesome. Let's talk about that year. Where were all the places you go? What did you see? What was your experience like?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I flew into Argentina, went to virtually all of the countries in South America, went to the bottom of Argentina, flew into Buenos Aires, went to the bottom of Argentina, then worked up through Chile and then across to Brazil and then sort of up obviously up north, and then went down the Amazon and Venezuela and Colombia. And yeah, super cool. Did that for a year, which is quite relatively common in Australia and New Zealand to do this sort of this overseas experience thing. It was awesome. But by the end, you know, I was still anxious to make my mark on the world. And I actually cut the trip short and only did about sort of 11 months because I really wanted to kind of get on with my adult life, my serious life, and start building things. So, flew from South America to London, which was the next kind of trip. And then, you know, that's where things, by a lot of luck and chance and a lot of grit, kind of started to gain a little bit of traction then. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that traction. What exactly happened?
Yeah, well, so I got to London. By then, I was super hungry to establish something. I was looking at the property market. The property was super red hot at that time in London. And after 6 months of being in London, after basically backpacking and not really having any credit record, I managed to buy my first property in London. And started renting that out. So by about 24 years of age, I was a landlord and, you know, managing this house of tenants in central London. So that's when I sort of got a little bit on the radar in terms of, you know, what I felt kind of achieving things. And then within 6 months, I had bought another place. And then within about 3 months, I bought another place and sort of then got into this whole property development thing. Kind of took off from there over about the next kind of 6 to 8 years, I suppose, in terms of property development.
So you're backpacking.
Yeah.
You have no sort of credit for the past, 11 months?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go and you somehow can borrow money or get a loan or something to purchase your first house. How did that go down?
Yeah, it's crazy, really. And look, I think all of us are blown by the winds of luck and timing and environment. I caught the tail end of a massive property boom in the UK. If I got there 3 years later, I wouldn't have been able to do it. If I got there 3 years earlier, I'd probably been worth, 100x more now. So where I got there, credit was still relatively easy to get, like these non-status loans. I hadn't been to the UK before. I was born there, but I had no credit history. I was with income, and I got a job and I worked double jobs.
Hey Derek, you kind of cut out a little bit.
Yeah,
you said all good. You said that you were born in the UK, but you had no credit there.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was born in the UK, but I had no credit. And but then when I got to London, I worked double jobs. I saved as much as I could and then bought this property as soon as I could. Obviously went to a lot of mortgage brokers trying to get mortgages. I got refused a huge amount of times. And but then eventually I was able to get the mortgage. I found the property that fit within that sort of criteria. And then I was sort of, I suppose, I had made that first big leap kind of thing.
That's incredible. So you started getting houses and houses, and so you're building up your portfolio. And what happened after there?
Yeah, so, I mean, I built a portfolio. It was going crazy at that time. That was about 2004, I think. I'm forgetting my my dates now. But it was going crazy at that time. You know, property growth was going about 25% per year. So you could refinance. I was then refinancing and buying more properties. I was then renovating properties. I was then splitting, as you did in London, you would split big houses into three apartments or whatever, refinancing. And then by about 2008, I bought a building of about 10 apartments, which was super exciting and sort of my biggest thing. And by then I had about, I suppose, 21 apartments, you know, worth kind of sort of towards, I don't know, about 10 million bucks, I suppose. So it was going well. And then the financial collapse happened, which obviously hit the US and the UK. As soon as I bought that place, there was a run on one of the banks, and that was on TV with people lining up outside. So an amazing time to live through and remember. I was safe, though. My properties were safe. I was able to make repayments. I wasn't really exposed to the downside, but it just meant that financing really basically froze, and I couldn't then continue doing what I was doing. So I had to look for a new avenue, a new, I suppose, job, a new business. And then out of that, I got into service departments or kind of corporate housing, as they call it in the US. That was 2009, which was the kind of same birth year as Airbnb. So, you know, it was quite interesting. Then over about the next 9 years, I built this service department portfolio up to about 250 apartments in central London. We then basically evolved alongside Airbnb in terms of usage and popularity and things like that. And then in 2016, I actually had to shut that company down. So that was the full cycle of that. But I basically bootstrapped this company up to about 20 million in revenues annually, obviously. But then because Airbnb basically started flooding the market with extra stock, there was huge margin compression, and we really couldn't make the numbers work. So I ended up shutting that down, which was hard.
So you built this empire, and then you shut it down. What did you do after that? Did you just go lay on the beach and, you know, hang out for a bit, or did you immediately get back into it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was very hard. It was about sort of 9 years in building this. And by then I had had two very significant successes, you know, obviously with my own property and then this business. And I was, I don't know, maybe whatever, early 30s. So, you know, pretty successful. Then obviously in the kind of downward spiral of this business, that was a really hard sort of 12 to 18 months, where you're obviously trying to rescue the business, you're trying to pivot, you're trying to do everything you can, you're trying to fundraise. I also sold basically a lot of my properties to put into this business to try and save it. And then it didn't, you know, and I closed this down. I lost literally millions of dollars. I lost the last 9 years that I invested into this business, basically. It was really, really, really hard. But, you know, you learn a lot. Super, super stressful, super horrible situation to be in. But then you know, as soon as it was over, I actually felt quite energized again, because it was actually the prior sort of 12, 18 months that were just exhausting and horrible. And, you know, you do your best. And then I actually, I did go to the beach. I went to Spain, south of Spain, and kind of sat on the beach for a while and started building my next businesses then. But it was only a matter of about a week. You know, I was exhausted. But after the business shut, it was actually my energy came back. I felt my creativity came back, and I could start kind of exploring again and more the creative side of entrepreneurship again. So within about a week, I was super, super energized and back on the horse.
What a roller coaster.
Yeah, I know, right? That's entrepreneurship.
Wow. So what would you say having built something that big and then having gone through such a difficult time, it's like, you know, like we were saying, a roller coaster. What were some of the biggest lessons that you took away from that?
Yeah, I mean, like, you live and learn. Huh? Like, one of my biggest lessons is not to do that again. Like, I'll try and avoid kind of losing my companies and my all of my assets. But, you know, there's billions of factors and there's billions of decisions that you make within the process. I don't want to be too vague, but I think it's very difficult to consolidate stuff into a little book and say, this is how you make $1 million. This is how you prevent losing $1 million, because there's so many factors. But you learn a huge amount through going through things, through the experience of things. And, you know, I believe after 20 years of business now that I am a very seasoned business person. And I think, you know, you really only learn when you've been really burnt and scarred. You learn incredible things then. You know, one of the major lessons I learned was the power of platforms. And this is now why I'm applying the platform business to my new industry, which is outsourcing. In service departments, not to go too deep into it, we were a supplier. So we provided the service of the service departments. We had very heavy capital expenditure, very heavy fixed costs, huge sort of commitment upfront to infrastructure. And I saw these platforms like Booking.com and Airbnb come in. They don't need to provide any hotels. They can basically just concentrate on the sales cycle. They're effectively very cost efficient. They don't have really any investment in any infrastructure, and they can take the vast majority of the margin. So, you know, that was one of the big lessons I learned. But obviously that's not a sort of universal lesson that anyone can take anywhere kind of thing.
But I think that is really valuable, because you've been on the side of creating the supply and you've seen the platform centric business just be the middle person and snap up a lot of that profit margin. I mean, that, like, if somebody's listening and they're like, should I go on the supply side or should I make a platform or a marketplace or something like that? Well, this could help them make that decision. So I definitely think that's very helpful, especially given all the context, the context of your story. So let's talk about that now. Let's talk about the outsourcing business and how you built it, what exactly it is. Let's get into the details of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll give you the sort of spiel and then we can dig into it a little bit deeper. But, you know, outsourcing has been going 25 years. It's really just staff augmentation. So you're getting, instead of staffing in the US or the UK, you're getting staffing in another country that is significantly cheaper, maybe 70% cheaper. Historically, Fortune 500s, the, you know, big conglomerates that could access this. And it's been going 25 years and it's a very proven model and it's highly successful, used by all of the big companies. But in the last 10 years, it's been accessible to the small and medium-sized businesses. But they're not really aware of this opportunity yet. And they're not really aware of how they can harness outsourcing. And it's really, you know, my mission now is to show small and medium-sized businesses that we are in a globalized economy. There are 8 billion people on this world, on this planet. There's, you know, probably about 3 or 4 billion earning less than $1 a day. There is this opportunity to equalize salaries, which is a huge opportunity to get incredibly well-qualified, hugely committed people working for your business at a significant discount to what you would be paying locally. So yeah, you know, fundamentally outsourcing is really remote-based working, taking advantage of the cheaper environments that some people live in. And it's a win-win, and it's basically a move towards a globalized economy where we are choosing the best people based on their merits, not on where they were born or, you know, the sort of lottery of life. So yeah, it's super interesting. We have, you know, as I said, outsourcing has been going 25 years, but there's no aggregator platform to help people explore and search and discover and learn about outsourcing. So we have created this platform.
Well, I just want to say I am a massive proponent of outsourcing and working with people from all over the world. Like, I would not be able to do all the things I'm doing without it. Like, I have a team that helps with Project Egg, and basically the way I've set it up is that obviously I'm here right now. This is me.
This is you.
Yeah. So I'm doing the interview, right? But the way I have it set up is with technology, software, and a team, my team can then take the interview, the content, and build the graphics, do all the internal stuff, get it published to the right platforms, make sure everything is taken care of, to where after this interview, I'm pretty much hands off, and I'm so grateful that my team exists and that they have chosen to share some of their time with me, because I mean it is like a huge weight and a burden is off of my shoulders so that I can focus on the things that are really, really important, like being present in this conversation and being able to, you know, to speak to incredible people like you. Like, that's what's going to actually move the business forward, not the little back office stuff, but the little back office stuff has to happen.
Yeah.
It has to happen. So I'm a huge proponent of outsourcing. So you said you're the platform that's really diving into outsourcing. So are you more education focused or more providing, let's dig into that more. What exactly are you doing?
Yeah, look, it evolves. Basically, we provide a spectrum of services. Without getting too confusing, it's a little bit like Alibaba, how they originally, now they've obviously changed what they do. They do everything now, but originally they basically aggregated Chinese manufacturers. These Chinese manufacturers basically would have had bad websites or no websites. They generally had bad English and didn't know how to connect their business to the West. And Alibaba came and aggregated that. It put them into a listing, made pricing simple so that consumers could understand what was on offer and engage easier with them. And then Alibaba in the West obviously then helped promote fundamentally Chinese manufacturing to the small and medium-sized consumers in the West. Now, you know, it's a very similar analogy because there's always been Chinese manufacturing outsourced from the US for maybe 30 years, you know, 40, 50 years. But Alibaba kind of opened it up to the small manufacturers, to the small and medium-sized enterprises in the West. And it kind of facilitated easier communication, easier education and understanding, but also trust as well.
You know, it brought it to scale.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the market can not only make the marketplace, can not only make things easier, but it can actually create a market. And, you know, you see that today in the, you know, you can get a 13-year-old boy watching Shark Tank. He comes up with an idea. He can get online and have his idea manufactured for him in China. That could not have happened 20 years ago. And it's because of these platforms that facilitate things and make it easier that they actually kind of create a market that maybe wasn't there before. So what we do in terms of outsourcing is quite similar. You know, outsourcing is relatively advanced. Well, I mean, it's very advanced, but generally their online presence and their sort of online marketing isn't up to scratch and it isn't where it should be. And outsourcing is one of the only industries in the world where the suppliers are in one country and the consumers are in another country, very similar to Chinese manufacturing. You know, because if you want to find a plumber, you know, you it's a local market, local to local. Whereas if you need to find an outsourcing supplier, you rely on these platforms to help connect people. So that's what we're doing. And, you know, we help facilitate this. Now, a lot of people don't know what outsourcing is. They don't know how to best harness it. They don't know how to protect themselves and use it properly and scale teams. So we offer search and exploration, but we also offer advisory and handholding and, you know, helping people structure their solutions. So we do the whole kind of range.
That's exciting. Now, it would seem like you probably need an educational component too, so that people can understand how to better utilize the outsourcing opportunities or to better take advantage of the outsourcing opportunities that are right in front of them. Because I know so many people that, you know, they talk to me about, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this. I'm like, okay, but you could charge like $200 an hour for your time, but you're doing something that you could instead pay somebody $20 to do. If you just outsource that, you're essentially coming ahead $180 per hour. Like, that's a good trade. That math works in your favor. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. So I feel like there are so many people who maybe they just think that it's out of their budget. Or maybe it's just too complicated. I think there almost has to be an education side of it. How are you tackling that that piece of it that you need?
Yeah, look, this is where you know, outsourcing is really no different to employment. And people overcomplicate what they think outsourcing is. And I just try and pull them back and go, hey, it's just employing someone, except they're not sitting beside you as they would have in the 1980s. You know, and now it's done. You're still colleagues or whatever, employees or workmates, but you're just then communicating through tools like Asana or Slack or Skype or Messenger or all of those. You know, and this is why outsourcing is becoming more prevalent, but also I believe it will hit this tipping point where suddenly everyone will be outsourcing, is because in our normal day, even if you are sitting in the same office, you're probably not talking and you're probably coordinating your work through email, Asana, Slack, and blah, blah, blah. So it's hitting this tipping point in terms of technology enabling this new form of work environment. But then, you know, it becomes apparent that why, you know, if you're sitting in New York, New York's a big city. I don't know how many people it's got, but like maybe 10 million. Why do you limit yourself to New York when the US has 300 million? North America maybe has 600 million. The OECD has, you know, 2 billion. I'm making these numbers up. But and why in today's modern world are we restricting ourselves to, you know, who can I find locally when there's this whole world market out there? And why get someone in New York for 10 grand a month when you could get someone three times as qualified with a PhD sitting somewhere else for 3 grand a month? And, you know, this is a super exciting thing. But in terms of outsourcing, how you do it, that crosses over into sort of management consultancy, management fundamentals, you know, how you build a hierarchy, a structure, how you delegate work, how you build processes and process mapping, you know, it becomes quite deep. And a lot of people get stuck on outsourcing, not because it's the outsourcing layer, it's because actually they're going through this process of learning how to build a company and manage people and build processes. So as an advisory, we have to sort of unpick that a bit. And very commonly, it's not, you know, the outsourcing is the bottleneck. It's just people are going through this process of learning how to delegate and scale and, you know, and build the business, which is a super exciting phase to be in.
Yeah, it is super exciting. And I think there are so many people who struggle with delegation that's like, I'm so happy that you're doing what you're doing because I feel like so many people need it. Mm. And again, it's one of those things where let's say we get everybody to start outsourcing and to get there, build their teams and have stronger, better organizations. That helps everybody. Mm. It is definitely a win when more businesses, more entrepreneurs can be successful. Like, absolutely, 100%. Because we are the backbone of the world economy. Like, that's why I get so fired up about this. Like, that's why I love doing the show so much. It's because we're providing value to entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs, beginner entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs who are already kicking ass. Like, that, yes. Yes. Yeah. So I'm so glad that you do what you do. So,
and it's a huge opportunity, you know, because, and look, outsourcing, let's face it, is a little bit ethically challenging. People go, what about jobs back home, the US? People are going to, you know, have to work for less. Look, there is an inevitability about the world becoming one marketplace. You know, I read this thing the other day that when Amazon started in only 1999, there were 16 million people online that was their potential audience. Now there's 3 billion, you know. So Amazon, if there was still only 16 million people online, Amazon would be a fraction of the size that it is now. And it's because everyone is coming online and there is this world marketplace happening. And it's good because, you know, you can sell Project Egg not to your hometown, whereas it previously would have been restricted to that. You have a potential audience of 8 billion people. So there's pros and cons to all of this. It also means that, you know, you can then access staffing from all over the world as well. People have to reframe this in that we are becoming one world economy, and it won't happen overnight, but in 20 years, because of all of this online communication, you know, soon we're going to have virtual reality, a lot of easier interfaces, that we're all going to be one marketplace and you can't stop it. But it's not to say that outsourcing will hollow out employment. It just really augments the opportunities for you to become a profitable business, for you to scale more, for you to pay, well, make more profits, pay more taxes, but also for you and your staffing at home in the US to make more, to do more valuable work, you know, like get the non-core work done by non-core people and get the higher value things done by people in the US and within your community. So, you know, it's evolving, and it always has evolved and it always will evolve. It's inevitable, but it's generally a very positive thing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I look at my analytics a lot,
right?
Because I like numbers and I like to understand. And what's amazing to me is that just in the past 3 days, oh, let's say 7 days, just in the past 7 days, the Project Egg show has been listened to by people in over 50 countries.
Wow. Crazy.
Over 50 countries.
Yeah, I can't even name 50 countries.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That is insane to think about. Like, that is so weird to think that I'm sitting here speaking to a computer and you're on, not only are you on the other side of the computer hearing me from your computer, but thousands and thousands of other people are hearing us talk, and people from so many different countries. Like, that blows my mind. And I love what you're saying about like the world becoming a global economy. Mm. Because, yeah, you can complain and say, oh, well, that's going to drive the price down of some work. Well, yeah, but you don't want to be doing that work anyways. That's not the good work you should be going for.
Yeah.
Like, what that also means is that there's going to be a world full of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be so much opportunity. Like, for example, one of the people that helps me out, one person on my team, she is in the United States. Another gentleman on my team, he is in India. And I have actually built out the system to where the gal here in the United States, she's more of like a manager, like operations.
Mm.
And so she helped, she really, and I'm so grateful for her. And if you're listening, you know who you are. Thank you. You're the best. But like, she has a huge bandwidth of like mental capacity and work capacity that like I pay her very fairly for that, right? And so because of the globalized market, she can command a higher value. She can, yeah, she can command a higher pay. And so she's doing it right. She's totally doing it right. And like, she's embracing a leadership position and a management position. And so when we have access as business owners, we have access to labor that and help and like support that is cheaper than an alternative. Like, if it's the same quality, but it's cheaper, like, mm, you have to do that for your, yep, business. That's just a no-brainer, unless you're trying to waste money. You have to do that. But that opens up the opportunity for everybody else.
Yeah. So, oh, of course, like, economic activity is good for everyone, and it's changing and evolving what economic activity means. You know, like, podcasts didn't exist 5 years ago. You know, it's crazy. And now people are making money from podcasting, and it's building a podcast economy. That is fantastic. That was not here 5 years ago. And, you know, there's a lot of people around the world that are working like for you and podcasters, all earning money, putting fuel into their economy, feeding their family. And this is a brand new industry that didn't exist. You know, it's incredible how things evolve, and people can very, you know, get fixated on what they're losing, or what's ending, or, you know, the fears, but, you know, no one's really celebrating the economy that's about to boom in podcasting, you know, and it's crazy. You know, I use this example in about 1890, the Greenwich Mean Time was created, which was the standardization of time zones. And the reason why that happened was, this was in England, because before 1890, well, they invented steam trains, which meant that people could get quickly between cities. And the towns in 1890 didn't have, in the UK, which is one time zone, did not have standardized times. So you would go from one town and it might be 4 p.m. to the next town and it might be 2 p.m. to the next town that might be 3 p.m. They had no need to standardize times because people never traveled between towns. And now, you know, people are traveling like between towns all the time, so they standardize time. But now, you know, people, our generation, are flying to countries every month or every week or every day. You know, and then, as you said, like, we're on Skype and you could connect with, and you're connecting with 50 different countries in one simultaneous kind of release. It's just incredible. And this is this movement towards there being one world economy. The one of the benefits to that as well is cities.
Wait, Derek, you kind of cut out on us. You cut out on us.
That's all good.
All good, all good. But the last thing we heard was one of the benefits is, it's a great cliffhanger, by the way. It's
awesome. Maybe I've lost my train now. So. No, but one of the benefits is big cities have far more productivity. You get the best universities in big cities. You get the best innovation in big cities. You don't get, you know, innovation in small towns. And that is because of the network effect. When you have good schools, they produce good workers. When you produce good workers, they produce good business. When and it kind of it becomes an exponential positive feedback mechanism. What we used to have was a lot of villages. Then there were collections of big cities. Now there are countries. But eventually we will have one world economy, which is 8 billion people connected together. And when you have connections of 8 billion, then there's going to be exponential kind of enhancement in productivity, in results, in production. And it's super exciting. And people need to see that as an exciting thing instead of, oh my God, someone's going to take my job kind of thing. Because I do genuinely see it as an incredible opportunity for humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you said opportunity, because newsflash, everybody, if you don't do anything about it and you just kind of wait for it to happen, it's going to bite you in the ass. And that is when you should be afraid. If you're not willing to do anything and you just want to kind of hold on to your ideology of like what you think things should be instead of looking to see what things are actually becoming, that's when you should be scared. But it's an opportunity, right? Because if you put in a little bit of work to shift your skill set or position yourself to be, you know, like a leader, right? A manager. If you can manage people, if you can lead people, tremendously valuable skill, right? But that was a tangent. But if you can position yourself and look ahead 5 years, like what is something that's going to be here or that may be more important in 5 more years? Position yourself there. Position yourself to be an expert in something that you can claim as yours, right? Because with 8 billion people, there will be so much opportunity. I mean, there already is an unlimited amount of opportunity. Like, even if every single person acted on every opportunity that they saw moving forward, like, we still couldn't possibly tap into all the opportunity that there is in the world, right? Let's just put that out there. But with a global economy, it's like that, but on freaking digital steroids. Like, that is amazing. That is amazing. And so you're going to have so many more people who can buy your product or service, or who you can work for, or who you can work with. Like, oh, I'm so glad the conversation went here, because we've never talked about this on the show, or haven't talked about it recently, and this is an amazing idea. I love it.
Yeah. No, it is. It's exciting. You know, there's going to be a lot of change, this is the thing about change, is that fundamentally change is good if 51% of people benefit. You know, ideally 100% benefit, but there will always be wins and losses with any change. And this is why change is resisted. And if it is 49% that lose out, then that is a tough change. But the net result is it still positive. And, you know, throughout history, there's kind of evolution, is continual little changes. And some people, maybe 51% win, sometimes 51% lose, you know, but it's kind of this painful change in evolution that we're going through. But fundamentally, things are getting better. Life is getting a lot better. You know, none of us have to go down coal mines anymore. If you do, you're wearing sort of protective clothing and you have machines to do the work for you. Life is getting pretty good for everyone. And, you know, it allows us to do things like this, which is more creative, more kind of exploratory, more cerebral in nature. And, you know, you're then not even editing your tapes afterwards. You can get that done by people. And I suppose that's moving towards that self-actualization of work, where you can do the things that really are the kernels. You know, it's sort of the kernel of the value, and then the rest gets done for you, which kind of, it allows society to get closer to what they want to do, always add value and be more productive in that. So yeah, it's exciting. Huh?
Yeah, it's super exciting. And I can't even begin to imagine when you when we start tapping into virtual reality, what that's going to be. Because I can see a future, and I've said this a couple times before, but I'm going to say it again. I kind of see this future where, let's say you have 8 remote worker employees or contractors.
Yeah.
Everybody can put on their little, you know, headset, sci-fi, big sci-fi headset, and like zone into it, right? But imagine like a virtual conference table where you can be like with all of your people, but they're wherever they are in the world, but you're all together in virtual reality. So you could have like a whole virtual workspace in a conference room. And I think that is definitely coming. And I don't think anybody's really thinking about that, but I'm not sure. But I think everybody's thinking about like virtual reality for games.
Yeah.
Or virtual reality for, you know, stuff like that, like more entertainment. But I think there's going to be such a big push in the professional space, in the business space for reality. Think about if you could try on a pair of shoes online without ever having to leave your couch. I mean, first of all, I think that poses a huge threat to an even bigger threat to brick and mortar stores. But also, like when we were talking about, so much more is productivity. And then it's almost like you're not even bringing on remote workers because you're all together online. I think there's going to be profound impacts that I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, the technology is, it's happening. It's happening. You know, it kind of seems slow, but I think if you look back in 10 years, you'll go, wow, that's really changed. Huh? But yeah, I think there is all this virtual reality coming through. Look, in terms of remote work, because remote work is like a cousin to outsourcing, and there is this whole remote work movement of people just in the US maybe working from there, you know, like kind of traveling around the US or going to Bali or Thailand, and having very meaningful careers. Fundamentally, you know, I think that in an ideal world, productivity is at its highest if everyone is sitting shoulder to shoulder in the same office. You know, I still sort of think that fundamentally people work better because, you know, people then work. And, you know, like I'm a pretty fit, disciplined guy, but I have never been able to work out at home. Whereas I go to the gym and I'm like, well, everyone's working out, so I suppose I'm going to work out. You know, and I really do worry that everyone's sitting at home when they've got a sofa there, they've got Netflix there, they've got popcorn. There's a lot of distractions that could hinder productivity. So I believe that the ultimate is kind of sitting shoulder to shoulder in an office environment. And so I, you know, I don't know whether this is sort of self sort of affirming, but I believe that ideally you have two offices. You know, one of them is in your hometown where you are sitting. You have a core of staff there, and then you have a sort of outsourced team somewhere lower cost, i.e. the Philippines, where they are then sitting together as well. They can have their team meetings. They can get leadership. They can have their water cooler moments where they're discussing work over lunch, you know, and that then becomes very powerful. I think as technology improves, you know, and as you say, we've got VR, so we're all sitting around a conference table. We're kind of there, but not there. I think then that need for being beside each other will be diminished. But until then, I still think that there is the highest productivity when everyone's sitting around the same office, because then you have that sort of organizational momentum and inertia and culture and things like that. So yeah, it's interesting, but I can see a future where there's a lot of different paths, you know, a lot of different choices, a lot of different options, which is again, super exciting.
Super exciting. And, I think on that exciting note, we should probably wrap this on up. Derek, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing this time with me. It's been very special, and I just want to say thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah, and to everybody who's watching, listening, I want to thank y'all from the bottom of my heart. Your time is very, very valuable, and I'm very grateful that you decided to share it with us today. So thank you. I love y'all. Y'all are the reason that I do this. and go rock. Thank you very much, and I'll see y'all on the next episode. Take care.
Okay, that was me being interviewed by Ben Gothard of the Project Ag podcast. And I encourage all of you to go and have a listen to his Project Ag podcast if you like the sound of it. As always, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/254 if you want the show notes for this episode. And if you want to ask us anything, then just drop us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.